That's the great legend himself, John Coltrane, opening up on Blue Train, the title track on the only album he personally conceptualized for the Blue Note label, and was released in 1957. The Recording Industry Association of America has certified it as a gold album. John Coltrane, of course, on tenor sax, Lee Morgan on trumpet, Curtis Fuller on trombone, Kenny Drew on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and Philly Joe Jones on drums, all of them extraordinary jazz men. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, February the 11th. And a couple of things before we get to the main topic. Well, the president is asking Congress for new war authorization with regard to ISIS, the Islamic State. And, of course, this is interesting because he had declared war some time ago, you may recall. And the reason he's asking for new authorization, he says, although some people would say, well, he's just asking for authorization for the first time, is so that the matter of troops will be the focus. Now, the president is going to be asking for this new authorization in order to assign troops, ground troops, against the Islamic State. Well, we'll be following this story, of course, but it is interesting that the president had denied in the beginning, and certainly John Kerry had followed suit and vigorously denied that the United States was actually at war. So you see these things happening, and you say to yourself, my gosh, I mean, it never ends. The deception and the double talk, the lying, the out-and-out lying just never ends. So here is Barack Obama closing in on his seventh year in office, and suddenly he decides that he's going to do things right. Remember, we had this long discussion, a very deep discussion, about his declaration of war, his unilateral declaration of war, which John Kerry said was really not war. He didn't say what it exactly was, except that it was something akin to a police action. But the president had said it was a war. Kerry said it wasn't a war. Then Kerry said it was a war, but a different kind of war. It was really more a police action. It was kind of like a hot pursuit of a culprit in a crime. So we needn't worry. And the United States is now, of course, under great attack itself, not just by ISIS, but even around the world, because this kind of covert action has become a little bit much. And for the people in the United States, you know, we need to start asking questions. We should ask questions. What is this thing that we are told we have, where the will of the people somehow matters in the scheme of things? Congress is doing whatever the heck it wants to do. The president is doing whatever it wants to do. And they're making it look like it's all normal and it's all above board and it's all according to the Constitution. None of it is. None of it is. And here we have a very mild-mannered, very affable guy, you know, the guy who said he was elected to end all wars. And he's as hawkish as they come. Well, so that happens today. Meanwhile, the United States is again stirring up trouble in Ukraine. And today, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel is trying to make some kind of a diplomatic inroad in trying to get a peace, some kind of a peace agreement established there. And, of course, it's because, again, the United States is involved, very, very much involved, backing the Ukraine government. And the whole issue is checking the Russian separatists, as they're called, who have decided that they will hold on to their portion of Ukraine. And there's a war. It is going to erupt into a major war. Everybody sees it. They've been talking about it for quite a while. And the European Union, the United States, are partners in trying, playing both sides of the fence. On the one hand, they say they want peace in the region, they want to stabilize things, they don't want this thing to escalate into a major war. On the other hand, they intend very clearly to provoke Vladimir Putin. They intend to provoke him into taking an action that will precipitate a major conflict. That's the whole point. So the United States, again, President Obama, the peaceful president, is going to be arming the Ukraine government, going to be arming them in order, you will see in short order, a provocative incident that will cause a reaction by Russia, that will cause another reaction by the European Union and the United States. And this is how wars start. This is how wars start. So we'll be talking about that probably in the coming week, because there's a lot that is linked here. These things are not happening in isolation, because what's going on in Ukraine is what's going on in Venezuela. The United States, again, showing itself to be the boogeyman in Venezuela, provoking, by overt and covert means, provoking an internal destabilization, provoking acts, provoking the conditions that are aimed at one thing. And we see it happening, unfolding before our very eyes, to bring the government down, to just bring it down and replace it with somebody, quote, we, unquote, like. This is how these things happen. They're all connected. They're all connected. We see that in Brooklyn, New York, there has been an indictment of the police officer who shot and killed Akai Gurley, who was attempting, he was a resident of the Pink Houses in East New York, the public housing project in East New York. On November the 20th, he and his partner were attempting to just leave the project. They were on their way out, and the elevator of their seven-floor apartment complex was not working, so they decided to take the stairs down. Coming up those stairs was Peter Lang, a rookie police officer. The stairwell was dark because, of course, repairs and maintenance are not high priority items in public housing projects. He fires a shot, fires another, and down goes Akai Gurley. He dies. And it is reported that in the immediate aftermath, Officer Lang was busy trying to contact his union representative rather than 911 to get medical help to an innocent man who was just trying to go on his way to do his business. Well, this is now reacting. The reaction has been that, oh, this is great. This is wonderful. This is but we should really have the attitude that this is just the way the system ought to work. This should not be such an exceptional thing. And it is noteworthy that it is an exceptional thing. A crime has been committed. It was ruled a homicide. And because one human being shot and killed another, there was probable cause for arrest. There was probable reason, good reason, to impanel a grand jury. And the grand jury has decided, according to reports, that the officer should come to trial on manslaughter charges. All right. The system should work. Now, you compare and contrast that to how the system did not work in Staten Island, just across the river, where Eric Garner was shot and killed by another police officer. Or how the system did not work in Ferguson, Missouri, where Michael Brown was killed by a police officer. The fact that this is so unusual that people are very optimistic and people are noting the rarity of it, this should be an indication of what's wrong. And it should be proof that the allegations of a two-sided criminal justice system are just absolutely correct. The mere fact that there's such a huge reaction about this, which should be par for the course. This is how the system should work. But it also raises another question, and I guess that should come later on because nobody's been tackling it so far. How is it that Officer Lang and there was his partner, I don't know the partner's name at the moment, but they were both rookies. And that's an unusual thing, to have two rookies with each other in what the police department said was a dangerous situation. Why would you assign two rookies together? the question about police administration here and decisions by police, this should be a huge topic in New York City right now. And the police commissioner should be made to discuss these things. But I want to talk mostly today. You know, we've been talking all week. This is what has been designated as Black History Month. And it's normal that in February we get a lot of, we concentrate a lot on issues affecting African Americans. But why is it that we think of it as about African Americans and not this entire society? And here too, even though there is this concession, it's a nice thing, it's a nice acknowledgement that we do have a sizable portion of the population of a particular cultural and racial orientation, that we celebrate the contributions of this group, that's fine. But we haven't been paying attention to what should be the major focus here. And that is, this group, this one group, for centuries now, has been doing everything possible to bring to the attention of the dominant group, which no longer will be dominant as of 2035, the need to humanize itself, to come to terms with its long and inexhaustible list of atrocities that continue. And there's only the sound of one hand clapping. There seems to be no real interest in coming to grips with this horrible problem. The ongoing Holocaust in America, predicated primarily along racial lines. It's a one-sided situation. The people most affected, the people most vilified, are the ones doing the talking and the heavy lifting and the making of attempts to ameliorate the situation. And for centuries now, have been meeting nothing but obstacles, impediments, resistance. There is no denying that this country has a lot in its history that speaks to its barbarity, its inhumanity, all in the name of white supremacy. How it has maintained itself, how it elevated itself and came to be a world power. How it maintains that position in the world. It should bother Americans that this lofty position in the world is directly linked to barbaric practices and a barbaric history that continues. But because there has been such a success in framing all of this barbarity and so much effort and energy and money and time has gone into creating a parallel reality, a different narrative altogether. We set these barbaric acts and we set this barbaric history aside, and we pretend that we really are a well-functioning, well-ordered society. And everything is telling us the exact opposite. When we look at the gap between rich and poor, when we look at the kinds of crimes just today alone, we learn of one white man just shooting and killing three Muslims in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, ostensibly over a parking spot. What is operating there? But the notion that the part is the whole is the part. If the whole narrative, the narrative of the whole, is that white is right in this country, then anyone belonging, any part of that whole, arrogates to him or herself that notion and will have to fight like hell against it to remain human, to just connect with people on a human level. But all along we have this insistence that they will not come to terms. We will not recognize the holocausts that have occurred here. We talked yesterday with Professor Lumpkins and his book, in which he used the word pogrom with respect to East St. Louis and the riots of 1917. We know of entire villages, entire towns erased from memory. Just this week, we had a report issued that said that lynching in America was far more pervasive than even Ida B. Wells had documented. It is a horrible story, but it's real. And it is real to people who know it, who have been through it, who are descendants of people who have been through it. This is real. And still with the history of barbarity, we were so reviled that of what we saw, as we should be. The Jordanian pilot set a fire. It pales in comparison to what happened on these shores. And not too long ago. By the tens of thousands, according to Ida B. Wells. In this new report that was issued just, I think it was just 2 days ago, they talked about the fact that lynching was a kind of spectator sport. People would organize picnics and have their deviled eggs, observing human beings being slowly roasted or their bodies pierced with all kinds of horrible objects and lynched before a cheering all-white crowd. This is not something that is so far in the past. And the report says that this history of lynching, the report is put out by the Equal Justice Initiative based in Atlanta, this history of lynching was itself an act of social and political and economic control, along with, of course, terrorism. These are not silly little arguments that one could just put aside and say, well, you know, we're over that now. That's done. Let's move on. First of all, it's not your call. But the people to whom these things matter have been trying for centuries to have a reasonable conversation about what needs to be done to correct the society, to bring it to some kind of human existence. And it's the sound of one hand clapping. All kinds of entreaties have been made. All kinds of plans have been put forward. All kinds of conferences have been held and reports issued and books written and protests made. And yet, we are today right at the same point as we were in the 1700s and 1800s and 1900s, the sound of one hand clapping. So I ask today, what does it take? What will it take? Should people even bother anymore about asking this society in so many ways to deal with it the way the Prime Minister of France said. He said, France, no question, France has an apartheid problem. France has to confront its ethnic, geographic, social apartheid. That's what he said. Prime Minister Manuel Valls. Lots and lots of negative reaction, but it is real. America continues to exist in a state of apartheid. And that was validated in recent times, back in 1968, when the National on Civil Disorders, commonly called the Kerner Commission, at the direction of President Lyndon Johnson the year previous, was directed to probe the causes of urban rebellions that were occurring in major black cities all over the country. What did they say? They saw, according, this was their official report, that America was moving toward two societies, quote, one black, one white, separate and unequal, unquote. Well, that was their observation in 1968. And they were just talking about the immediate situation. What would their opinion have been had they been charged to discuss the history of America? But if in just that short time, in that little window of time, they were able to see this, that de facto apartheid exists, de jure apartheid exists in the United States, and that it was imperative to confront it, to do something about it. Well, Johnson decided that he could respond through legislation, and his war on poverty programs attempted to attenuate the social, political, and economic impact of this yawning divide that the commission had identified. But what about society as a whole? What's the attitude of white America? Well, for the most part, from what I have observed, the attitude is, that's not our problem. It's not our problem that other people are suffering. Slavery was not our problem. I wasn't born yet. Racial discrimination is not my problem. I'm not a racist. Some of my best friends are black. It's not my problem to fix society. I could only do what I can do. So, to the extent that any of this can be fixed, understand that it is not within my power to do so. Besides which, it's a bygone era. It's done. It's over. Let's get over this thing. You know, can we just draw a line and say before this time it will not exist, and from this time on we will deal with it. But we can't carry this burden. This is not something that we should be worried about. We should not be worried in the year 2015 what happened in 1619. We can't carry these burdens forever. We can't fix this. It's beyond our ability. Well, that's funny because the United States seems not only willing but able to fix these kinds of problems all over the world as part of its campaign to just rule the entire planet. It boasts about its ability to fix things, to set things right, to create harmonious societies, to bring peace and justice to the land, because it is the exemplar of fair play and democracy. It values human rights. It knows how to implement things because it is the most powerful nation in the world with the best of everything at its disposal. The best science, the best knowledge, the best capability. But we can't seem to fix this. And we simply do not seem willing as a society. It's still the same people talking. It's the same people complaining. It's the same people fighting for their rights. It's the same people on the streets screaming about injustice. But it's the sound of one hand clapping. Where are the white leaders? Where are the white liberals and progressives? What have they to say about the state of affairs in America today, where a continuing Holocaust is occurring? Native Americans are some of the worst off people in this nation, the First Nations people. Their land stolen from them, their culture stolen from them, and being sunk, all of their land now under federal management. And we have discussed on this program how horribly cheated they have been. The mismanagement of their resources by the federal government. They are in a situation more like the African American community and increasingly like the Latino community. In other words, what we're seeing is a compounding of the problem. And it's more and more evident and it's more and more ignored. So we have to ask the question. To what degree does white America assume any responsibility for setting things right? Or is it not so important because white supremacy affords a level of privilege that they do not wish to part with? I was once in a talk I was a member of the audience, where the speaker asked the question of a member of the audience, a white person, how much money do I have to pay you, or would you accept, to trade places with me? What's your figure? And the person, who clearly would have identified himself as a liberal, as a forward-thinking person, would not answer. Because this is the thinking. This is the pervasive thinking. Yes, I know we have trouble in America. Yes, I know there are black people who are suffering, and Latinos and Native Americans. Yes, 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 yes. But you know what? I can write you a check, or I can voice my opinion, but I am not going to undertake anything beyond that. I do not see it as my job to fix things. This is not part of my consciousness. This is not part of my responsibility. So I asked a question. At what point is there going to be a definitive cleavage in America based on this? The insistence by one group that injustices be addressed, and the insistence by the other group that these injustices don't matter enough to become involved in and to take on as part of the responsibility of good citizenship. That's the question. We'll take this short break, and I'll come back to your thoughts about this question at 888-874-4888. Thank you. Right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead, and we're talking about the sound of one hand clapping. During this Black History Month, it is worthwhile to pursue this discussion, because in the end, this is a shared society, even though racially bifurcated, even with racial holocausts. And so the question comes, and we have to deal with it. I've been asking, what is going to be the nature of our conversation? Because at some point, it will stop. And all will lose. The conversation will stop because people will determine that, look, a couple of centuries of this is turning up the same result. It would be crazy to believe that it would be any different. So, we have to find our own way. And it's going to be absolutely one-sided. The opportunity has been existing for hundreds of years to do the right thing here as a society, for government and individuals to understand how really serious this matter is. to sweep it under the rug, to ignore it, to deny it, is to invite peril for everyone. And so I'm saying that we have to get to this question. We have to ask, where is the responsibility? Where are white people in this conversation? Where are their leaders, for lack of a better term? We started this Black History Month, if you will. We started it with a very important conversation with Jeff Perry, based on the book by Theodore Allen, The Invention of the White Race. And we saw the scientific basis for this, for where we are today. And we've been talking about these things all the time on Lead Stories. We don't wait for Black History Month to talk about these things. But this is a very serious matter. And the longer we find a delay in discussing it, the longer we are toying with a cataclysmic outcome. Because at some point, decisions are going to be made. And they may not necessarily be the best. People may think that they're not necessarily the most just. But decisions will be made. Who is white America's, who are white America's ambassadors to this ongoing discussion? And what are they saying? What is the alternative to where we are as a society? We are not in good shape by any index by which we measure progress. We are not in good shape at all. And at the root of it, and this has been the case now for centuries, at the root of it is this business of white supremacy. We have been in a state of apartheid for centuries now. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. I want to hear from you. I mean, serious consideration. What do you see as the attitudinal issues that have to be overcome here? What are the challenges? Why aren't these conversations being had and translating into policies that lift the society as a whole out of this morass, out of this abyss that we've been stuck in for so long? Maat, you're on the air.
Yes, a good afternoon, Yutrice, and to the PR in our family. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes, I can. These
are excellent questions, and it was almost serendipitous that you had mentioned the discussion that we had mentioned, and it sort of foresaw Jeffrey coming on around Theodore Allen's work. I think it concerns a larger issue in this respect. As I saw the young people coming together in Black Lives Matter and all, and now the suit against the debtors' jail in Ferguson and Jennings, I asked myself, where have you been in terms of the overall picture of the fraudulent war against terror, the perpetual wars, brown people routinely being killed all over the planet? So I guess what I'm saying is we see so-called white folks, and it is a status quo, not really being concerned about who's warred against around the world. And I think that we can't depend on them to wake up to that, because when the war is abroad, it absolutely comes home, like we see with India, et cetera, Patriot Act, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we as African descendant people have to see the larger picture, analyze where we are around the globalists, the Federal Reserve, the covert government, the shadow government, as it were. We have to truly wake up, be wide-eyed before we can deal with this issue. And somebody on Book TV wrote a book on...
Wait a minute. Hold on a second. But what does that do for the conversation? What does that do for the formulation of solutions to the objective conditions that prevail?
Right. We must come together, which is such a hard thing for black folks to do to begin with. And we must look at where we are, how serious it all is, and we must not depend on, in other words, in order to come up with the solutions, we have to have a good understanding of where we are, what we can expect. For example, the higher-ups of the police and the political system are not the ones that are going to solve this problem or any of these problems. And we can't depend on waking up white folks. You know, we have to educate them about the fact that they're an invented and they live from cradle to grave as in a sort of illusion, delusion.
But I disagree with the way you're putting this, because I believe in what you say. You're pointing to a deficit, and the issue is that there's a deficit all around. You're pointing to the deficit among blacks to be real about their conditions, and you're also pointing about a deficit among whites to acknowledge that there is a problem and that they are also to be part of a solution. So I just wanted to point that out to you.
Excellent, excellent. I'll digest that and I'll listen to some other callers. Thank you for the opportunity, Utrecht.
Thank you, Matt, for calling. From Rosedale, Jose, you're on the air.
Greetings, my sister. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
You know, whenever I listen to you, I'm an elder, but whenever I listen to you, I just feel as if I'm getting a lesson in life. And I thank you for that.
Thank you.
You know, I don't think it has dawned on us as a race of people that we will never find a solution to our liberation coming from those folks who have enslaved us for centuries and intend to keep us in this condition. And I like to refer to many of the teachings of those who have gone on before us. You are right here teaching us and trying to point us in the right direction. But I also like to refer back sometime to some of those that have gone on before us, and this being African history, the holy month of African history. And to something Mr. Garvey once said, and I quote, "If you are strong, you have justice on your side." He said, "If you are weak, you are at the mercy of the dispenser of justice." He said, "There is no justice but strength. There is no justice but power. And if you have sense and you want justice, you get power. Get it quick. Get it anyhow," unquote. And Malcolm would say, "By any means necessary." I see so many times our people white people have the solution to solve what is happening to us. But it is not going to come from them. And if we cannot find it within among us, within ourselves, with the intellectuals, all the leadership that we have, the conscious leadership, to try and find a solution out of this condition that we are in, we are doomed. Because the plan is not for us to rise up as a race of people, neither here in the Western Hemisphere nor on the African continent. Because when I look and see what is happening to us, we have the European nations who have colonized, they enslaved and colonized our people, and they plan to rob and plunder our resources from now until their God come back. And we are here still trying to figure out how we're going to get out of this. And I'm just as confused as everybody else, but I know our solutions are going to come from those who have enslaved us and constantly have us in this condition that we are in. What are we as a people? What are we going to do? What are the plans that we have? And I'm here waiting for that epiphany. I'm involved in different organizations, and I am trying to see where that awakening is going to come from. But I haven't seen it.
Let me ask you, Jose.
Yes.
In your day-to-day life,
mm-hmm.
are these the thoughts that you carry?
Yes.
Why?
You know, Sister Eutrice, I said all the time that I shed a ton load of tears every day for my people and myself, but that I don't, that tear don't run down my outside my cheeks anymore. It runs down inside my cheeks, come down my chest cavity, finds its way into my bladder, and then when at a certain time I go and I dispose of that those tears, because as I said, I've been with many organizations. I've been there. I was even a member of UAM and NAN and so on and so forth. And there's a time when you try to bring out certain things and ask them to go in a certain direction. And you look and you see where it is not happening, and they're the ones with the answers, with the solutions. You are just a conscious follower. There's a time when your consciousness tells you that you have to move on to something else. So I'm trying to figure out, where are we going? This evening there's a I think tomorrow there's going to be a gathering in at the Maisley's. I meant to ask you this to my sister. I see where Uncle Bernard is back at BAI, and I wondered if back at the scene of the crime, and I wondered if maybe we might see you there one of the time pouring libation on that place to. but anyway, they're meeting there tomorrow to have a discussion. Calvin Butts and all these people are going to be there to discuss what. I go to these things over and over and over again, and there's a discussion, and these are the folks with the brain power and all the academic background and everything. And they're not coming up with solutions to bring our people together to do something. And I ask myself, what is it, a little person like myself, what can I do? Other than what to go and to try to voice my concerns and see how we can create something, but it is not happening.
Well, you've given us quite a bit to think about, Jose, and I want to thank you so much for calling today. Because what we're getting from you and from Ma'at, who called before you, the situation is not pretty on either side of the fence.
No.
And so the question still is there going ever, is there ever going to be a dialogue? Is there ever going to be some kind of a plan? Because while things are not happening, life goes on. Life is going on. And we seem to be descending every day into a deeper and deeper part of this abyss.
Exactly.
And, how do we get out? How do we get out? That's the question.
I thought those that had the academic skill, the intellectuals, those who are out front, those who you cannot get a word in to say to them, this is what I this is the direction I think we should go in and so forth. We don't seem to be listened to. When you go to these discussions, these conferences, it is always a group of folks, a fixed group of folks that are always there that seem to know it all. And then they grant you sometimes a favor in letting you ask a question. You can't even most time get a chance to formulate all your thoughts in saying what you want to say. They believe that you just ask a question, they answer because they have all the answers, and that's the end of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you again for your call today. I really appreciate your point of view. Thank you.
Thank you, my queen.
Thank you. So this is where we are. And we're seeing that, I mean, I don't think it is a hopeless situation. I'm just saying that we have to appreciate the reality of the situation that we're in. Because it is going to get worse. There's no question about that in my mind. Things are going to get much, much worse. And if we understand after all this talking and studying and reading, we understand the nature of the system that we all are living in, and we understand how it operates, we understand what it has done and what it continues to do, And yet we don't see any movement to some kind of a solution. Then we have no choice but to lay the blame on ourselves, and we have no choice but to accept the inevitability that decisions will be made that we are not a part of and that we may not like, but it would not be within our power to do anything about it. So this is where I continue to ask the question, where is the conversation going? Is there a conversation at all? Is there a need to have a conversation? Have we exhausted our possibilities? Is it naive to think that apartheid in America is a problem that society as a whole wants to solve? Or should we just decide that that's supposed to be the operative assumption and move accordingly with that as the stated principle of how the society operates? I mean, these are the questions. And I'm glad that we had some time to talk about that today, because it of course, you've listening to this program, you know it's a recurring theme. I ask, where's the conversation? Where is the conversation being had? And what is the conversation that we are supposed to be having at this time in our social, political, and economic evolution? What responsibilities do we have with respect to this conversation that is not yet happening? Thank you so much for joining me today, and I hope this brings to your mind a need to think about this question a bit. Keep it right here at prn.fm. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Always a pleasure and a privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.